Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I know that some in our audience know the finer points of hockey.
The Chris Johnston Show.
We are your friends.
The biggest stories, bringing you inside the game.
What did you hear?
The Chris Johnston Show.
What is going on?
Here's Chris with your host, Julian McKenzie.
Part of the game.
CJ, Gary Bettman, and Bill Daly spoke. And whenever those two speak, touching on a ton of topics, we have to go in on what they said. The Arizona Coyotes were a topic with those two. CTE and Chris Simon, the longtime NHL enforcer who passed away this week, also a discussion topic. And I'm sure there were other things that were mentioned as well when they met with media following the GM meetings this week. Let's dive into the Arizona situation first, but let's try to get to as much as we can of what Gary and Bill had to say this week.
Yeah, I mean, by far the most, I'd say, pressing, pointed questions, you know, were around what's to become of the Coyotes, because, look, it's the end of March, and I would say it's still not 100% certainty that the Coyotes will be playing in Arizona next fall. Now, you know, we could interpret some of Bill Daly's comments to indicate that that's still likely to happen, but, you know, I think the fact that it's an open question, that the league has to finalize a schedule within these next couple months, that the Coyotes owner, Alex Morello, is currently involved in a land auction to try to secure some land where he'd like to build a new arena. But like, what time frame is that all going to go down on? Is it enough to satisfy the NHL and the NHLPA? Because you don't just, you know, you don't just buy land and have a nice arena built within a year. You know, that's typically a long process. And so for all those reasons, there was a number of questions. I would say 60% of what the press availability on Wednesday, you know, down in Palm Beach was basically devoted to those topics. And, you know, I would say not a ton of clarity, although a couple sort of cryptic comments. You know, Bill Daly did say it's getting late. He acknowledged that, you know, while they're not placing a specific deadline publicly on it, it's very clear that, you know, I know fans are probably tired of this subject, but it does actually feel a little different this time around. I do think, you know, what's changed versus the last 12 years where the Coyotes have been in some degree of flux, and maybe even longer than 12 years, frankly, is that they've now coming to the end of a second season in a college arena, and they still don't have a firm plan. I mean, obviously they have the idea of what they'd like to plan, but every year that passes where there's no resolution or you know, I think that the pressure goes up there to come up with something. And I'll leave you with one thought before you follow up, Julian. I would say this. The NHL, I'll tell you the dirty little secret. They're going to say forever that the Coyotes are playing next season in Arizona until they're not. Like, they're never going to roll out publicly, like, the plan B, the idea that, oh, we've got two schedules, or the deadline is May 18th and they have to give us X, Y, and Z by that time. Like, it's never going to go down that way. The league is going to, of course, publicly just say we're working, you know, with the ownership there. We're supporting them. We have to, you know, they're not going to tell us it's going to happen until it happens. And that's very much what went down with the, you know, Atlanta moving to Winnipeg. It almost felt like overnight. Now, there was a lot of machinations behind the scenes back then, but it was on May 31st, I believe it was 2011 or 2012.
2011.
The league announces the team's been sold. There's a relocation field and they're moving to Winnipeg immediately. And, you know, I'm not predicting the same thing necessarily plays out here, but I think that's the most instructive recent-ish example we can point to of what could happen, you know, with Arizona. Though I think the situation is a bit more complicated because, you know, I don't know if you have an owner that wants to sell, you know, whereas the Atlanta group, you know, at that time they were turning in the keys. They just wanted out of their investment. It had been not a successful one for them. Yeah, I think the circumstances are a little different here, but, you know, it's getting a little bubbly and spicy. I mean, we've seen the temperature go up on this, even back to, I think, to Marty Walsh's availability at the NHL All-Star weekend, where he really put Arizona on blast. You know, and the human side of this, you know, I do know that there's a lot of players and people that work for that team. Like, they don't know, like, do we renew our leases on our houses or condos, or, you know, like, there's some sort of fundamental questions if you work there, that I think that they're not getting a lot of answers on right now. And so that's all the reasons why when the commissioner and the deputy commissioner get in front of the microphones, they're you know, getting a lot of pointed questions from reporters.
So what are the next steps for Arizona and notably owner Alex Morello, who we know is bidding on a plot of, well, 95 acres of land in Northeast Phoenix?
Well, it sounds like, according to Gary Bettman, that land auction is due to happen at some point in June. And, you know, essentially my understanding of a land auction is you go there and you bid on it and highest bidder wins. So, you know, that's the next best plan for Coyote's ownership. You know, you'll recall they had extensive plans and a referendum in Tempe to get an arena built a year ago that didn't happen, that didn't pass the support from the local taxpayers. You know, so it's down to a what if. So what if it gets to June and, you know, this land auction happens and Morello gets the land? You know, how long still, if he gets land before he can build the arena, is that going to happen on a time frame that'll satisfy the NHL? I don't know that answer. The bigger one is if he doesn't get that land, you know, I would think at that point that's going to be a pretty good sign that something, you know, has to change. I don't think the league can allow a third season, you know, start the next season in a college arena without, you know, very firm plans to have an arena built. And so that's the next step, big picture from the Coyotes end of things. You know, it's been a really difficult time there. I should have looked up their record, but, you know, since those comments from Marty Walsh, that the Coyotes have not won a lot of games. I think I'm not tying it. It's not a one-to-one correlation, but I think the fact that Marty spoke as openly as he did at that point in time in early February was a sign of how much the temperature had been going up and how much frustration is building from players and staff and a lot of people that work for the Coyotes. You know, the team actually had mild success for the first half of the season. And it has the feeling that things are kind of coming apart at the seams here. And so I don't know what all the machinations are going to look like, but I would say this is not going to be the last time we talk about the Coyotes in the next few months, because I do think, you know, we're starting to face the possibility that they're not going to be there. Like the real possibility seems to be growing with each passing week or month where there's not a resolution.
So when you hear Bill Daly say it might be too late, at least for them to be moved out of Arizona for next season, what are you thinking?
Well, what's weird about that is, so Bill said that he was asked, I'll give you the exact back and forth, because I think it instructs kind of why it's a little weird. He was asked specifically, if it gets to June and the land auction happens and they aren't successful in securing that land, would there be enough time to pivot and move the team somewhere else after that point for next season? And he said something to the effect of, you know, probably not. I don't think so. And so he was then asked specifically as a follow-up, so does that mean they're going to play there next season no matter what? Because, you know, you want to let it. And he's like, I'm not going to interpret my own comments. He's like, I'll leave it to you to interpret the comments. And so I would say this. My understanding is there's still a world they don't play in Arizona next year. But you know, I like to put my cards on the table. I don't bluff or BS the 100%ers or the 72%ers or whatever you are out there. If it's the first time you're hearing one of our shows, I don't know exactly what that means. I don't understand what could force them to move before June, but I don't think it's 100% guaranteed, even despite that comment from Bill Daly, that the Coyotes are playing, you know, out of Mullet Arena next year. So, you know, I'm flying a little blind here with the natural follow-ups you're going to have. I don't have the answers to them, I think is the best way to put it. And so, you know, it's going to be dramatic. I point back May 31st. There's proof of concept there that you can move a team that gets sold by May 31st. So, you know, I would think once we get, I mean, April is around the corner. Coyotes' last game of the season is April 17th, a home game against Edmonton. You know, the next 4 to 6 weeks from that point, I think will be compelling and instructive when it comes to seeing what the future of the franchise is. And so that's the best I can give you right now. There was not a lot of clarity, as you can tell, but I think the questions and the way they were answered did reflect that this is a serious situation. Like there's no, you know, there's sometimes where a big story in the media, you know, results in Gary Bettman getting a number of questions on a topic, and he'll be like, what are you guys, like, almost like being dismissive, like, this is silly, like, what, he was clearly not going to give a lot of information, but I think he understood why we were asking, and he wasn't trying to downplay the, you know, how important of a time this is in determining the Coyotes' future.
Yeah, well, buckle up. It's going to be a very busy situation. We'll definitely be touching on
that.
Here's
one other thing I'll say. You know, if you're Alex Morello, you own the franchise. Like, if you manage to buy that piece of land, I think the franchise value goes up. Because there's a world where, and I'm not saying he'll sell, but there's a world where if he gets that land, he could then sell. And you're not just selling the Coyotes, you know, whatever, the rights to have an NHL team and all the contracts and everything that the assets that organization owns, you know, you're buying the Coyotes and a place where you could build an arena. And so I think from him maximizing the value of his return, this is important, because it's an important distinction, Julian. Like, the last NHL team to sell was the Ottawa Senators. You know, the Senators were sold to Michael Andlauer with an arena, right? Like, an actual piece of real estate and acreage in Kanata. And the team itself. I mean, the Coyotes right now don't have that. They would only be selling the rights to have a team, and obviously the players that are under contract and everything that is associated with that. And so this is really important for Alex Morello, no matter what his future is as Coyotes owner, I think, to try to get a piece of land, because you're at least, it's one more asset that you would be selling with the organization potentially. And so that's his version of things. And then the league is kind of a separate entity. The league has to look at it and be like, is this what's best for the NHL? Like full stop. Like, forget the NHL. I mean, obviously they care about the owner of the team. I don't mean to suggest that, but they're not as worried about maximizing Alex Morello's asset value. They're like, what is best for the league? And especially as time's going along and frustrations are going to boil over. I mean, I think it's very conceivable you could have people that work for that team speak out publicly if it all just stays up in the air for a long time. I mean, I'm sympathetic, quite honestly. I mean, people are tired of maybe the larger subject, but there's actual humans that work there that don't know where they're going to work next year. And that, you know, that needs to be clarified sooner than later.
I'm glad you brought that up, because we do forget about that when we discuss the Arizona Coyotes. That's a very fair point.
Yeah. And I've heard sort of through the grapevine that emotions are boiling, if not yet boiling over, behind the scenes.
Bettman and Daly also took questions about Chris Simon during their availability this week. Chris Simon, longtime NHL enforcer, passed away this week. A couple of tributes poured out from different NHL teams. But one statement here I'll read from Paul Theofanis. That's the agent of Chris Simon. The family strongly believes and witnessed firsthand that Chris struggled immensely from CTE, which is the disease from constant head trauma that we've heard so much affiliated with football and other contact sports, which unfortunately resulted in his death. Chris's passing is tragic. It's sad. This is a quote, I believe, from Bill Daly. It's sad, or Bettman. We extend our deepest condolences to his family and friends. On all these matters, we wait to see what the medical experts tell us. Having said that, I think it's well documented all the progress that we've made over the last couple of decades to make the game as safe as possible. Bill Daly said, I think the science is still lacking. What were your thoughts on how Bettman and Daly addressed CTE when it came to Chris Simon this week?
Well, Bill Daly's a lawyer, and I can understand why he would say that. I mean, I think that as time has gone along and there's more research done in this field, the link between repeated head blows and CTE is becoming more clear, you know, but that's what the NHL is disputing, because I think they're probably protecting themselves legally, is my interpretation of what happened there. You know, I think first and foremost, though, you know, it's got to be said that there's a tragedy involving Chris Simon. You know, it's an apparent suicide that ended his life. And, you know, CTE can only truly be identified through an autopsy of a body. And so, you know, we'll wait to see if that's able to happen in his case, what that shows. But I'm certainly not disputing his family's belief that they believe that that's what caused a lot of the problems in his life. And, you know, you almost don't want to focus on the end of someone's life sometimes, because of how they lived. And you know, Chris Simon was, he accomplished a lot. I mean, I don't just mean that you can look at his stats and say 800 plus games, and he was part of a Stanley Cup winning team and, you know, a couple others that had long playoff runs. He scored and had a 29 goal season. I mean, all those things are true, but you know, he came, you know, from Canadian First Nations background, you know, to make the NHL. He very early in his life beat addiction, and was quite open during his career about, you know, how challenging that was for him to stop drinking specifically. You know, obviously had a lot of ability in addition to the fighting that became part of his game. And he played in the era where there was a lot of fighting. And you know, I was thinking, you know, when thinking on this topic and reflecting on Chris Simon's life a little bit, I mean, we had the talk recently about Matt Rempe, right? And, you know, this is the part where, remember, we were both sort of saying we can acknowledge, as much as we know it's probably not the right thing, that we can enjoy a fight or some of the emotion in that game. I mean, this is the counter argument, is that, you know, certainly fighting is way, way down from Chris Simon's era. But, you know, there's probably, when you look at the number of enforcers, former NHL enforcers that have died, it's staggering. It, you know, died by their early 50s or in their 40s or 30s. You know, back to Derek Bugard, Wade Bielak, I mean, Todd Ewan, Bob Probert back in the, I mean, a lot of patterns there. I mean, obviously there's some substance abuse issues, but that could be tied to doing the job potentially. I mean, you know, just it's the counter argument to celebrating fighting, frankly. And it probably should give us reason to think, why is there fighting at all? That's permitted with just a 5-minute penalty assessed. You know, why isn't there stricter rules? I mean, I don't know that there's anything you could do that could 100% take it out, but you could start giving suspensions for a fight, and that's going to clearly curb the desire for players to do it. And it's probably going to just, you know, teams naturally then are not going to carry a player that's sort of designated as a fighter. Anyway, I'm kind of rambling a little bit, but you know, it's hard not to. I think we'd be disingenuous if we didn't at least make the tie that, you know, part of what's being celebrated about Matt Rempe, and then you have, you know, a player that was celebrated for doing that very thing, you know, having a very tragic and way too soon end to his life. I mean, if you're not thinking about that, I think, and in the NHL's case, potentially acting on it, not just because of Chris Simon, but again, it's just one more example. It's, you know, it's a tragic situation and one that, you know, I think that hockey, it has definitely moved to safe. Like, I don't dispute Gary Bettman's quote. Like, it is a safer game, but is it as safe as it can be? I don't think the answer is yes.
Well said. And obviously, on behalf of both of us, we extend our condolences to the Simon family. That is a tragic situation. Were there other notable topics that Gary and Bill delved in on during their availability that you'd like to bring up?
There wasn't a whole lot else. I mean, there, you know, there was some, I'd say, smaller things. You know, Bettman talked about league revenues again, projected at $6.2 billion for HRR, which, if you're a fan out there, probably what the biggest takeaway is, it's been a pretty good year business-wise for the league, and the salary cap's still likely to go up by a little less than $5 million next season, which I think should spark the trade market a little bit, or should just lead to a little bit more fluidity in the system, because we're kind of bogged down. You know, maybe the one topic that didn't get a lot of discussion, at least in an official capacity, was the LTIR stuff. And, you know, it's my understanding, you know, there's an executive board of GMs, six GMs that met Sunday with the commissioner and Bill Daly, sort of to set up the week, to go over the, you know, the agenda of events and what was being discussed, maybe to focus a discussion. Because as you can imagine, you get in a room with 32 general managers who are coming from different standpoints, who might have different issues because something's happened to their team or not happened to their team that they, you know, you could see how that might devolve into an unfocused discussion. But it was at that meeting on Sunday with the commissioner where I think they sort of made it known to the GMs, like, okay, we can't have an unfocused discussion on LTII. You guys need to go and canvass all your own managers and see if any consensus internally can be brought up of how this might be addressed. But I would say in a few private conversations I had that there was a little more, there seemed to be a little more appetite than I would have guessed, Julian, for some kind of playoff salary cap type of thing to eventually be brought in. And so, you know, as we know, this can only happen through a CBA negotiation with the players. I think the NHLPA is still gathering from players. Like, is this a problem that we should address? Is this something we should consider? And so I don't really know where it goes, but there's certainly, there's a lot of GMs who aren't doing this because they think Vegas is cheating or Tampa cheated. It's not about, I think that's the way the story kind of gets told in public, right? It gets simplified to that. But I think it's more just a reflection of there's got to be a more fair model to apply a cap in the playoffs. Because here's the thing. Teams are allowed to exceed the salary cap by 10% in the summer. They obviously have to be cap compliant starting the first day of the season. And then you get around to the playoffs, the most important time of year, and there is absolutely no cap. And I think that fundamentally just some GMs are wrestling, like, does that make any sense? And, you know, I heard, again, a suggestion from, you know, one who just said, why don't on a playoff game day, we have to basically put in a lineup for that day at 5 p.m., you know, prior to the game, say maybe noon if it's an afternoon game. But, like, the point being, a roster just that only applies for that one day, but that is cap compliant for whatever the cap ceiling is that season. And that might make some sense. I don't know all the complications for it. It is a nuanced conversation, but anyway, it was a topic of discussion in the bar. I would say it was not a topic of discussion in the meeting room, because I don't think that the commissioner wanted it to devolve into chaos. And again, it's almost a moot point, because ultimately if there's a decision that they need to try to change something, they have to then involve the Players Association. And so that's a whole separate process that really has nothing to do with the GM. So where we're at now, the GMs are talking amongst themselves. They're meant to report back and say, like, is there a consensus for how we want to try to do this? Should we be trying to address this? And then maybe there'll be a broader conversation with the Players Association.
Is there any correlation with, say you want to implement a playoff salary cap, maybe you go that one step further and you pay players during the postseason too? Like, I just wonder if that makes sense.
I don't.
Or if that's a bridge too far to connect.
I don't think so. I mean, the way the players essentially get paid in the playoffs is there's playoff bonuses. Like, each team that loses in the first round gets a certain amount to split amongst themselves. Loses in the second, loses in the third, you know, winner of the cup, loser of the cup. So players get paid in the playoffs. It's just by virtue of a bonus that's given to their team that they split up. I don't think that would do it. I guess it's more about, like, does it even matter? I think it's almost sort of a more of an existential question than a nuts and bolts question. But, you know, a team like Vegas, and again, I'm not suggesting they did anything wrong. Like, this is literally what the rule is there for. But they, you know, they acquired a player like Noah Hanifin using space that was created because Mark Stone is out of the lineup until at least the playoffs and probably into the playoffs. But if it gets to a point where Mark Stone is healthy, and they also got Thomas Hertl too, right? And Anthony Mantha, like guys who don't make just league minimum salaries. I know there was salary retention in some of those trades, but don't miss the point. The point is, if Vegas in May and they're in the second round gets to a spot where all those players are healthy, but then they're icing that a roster that's maybe a $95 million roster. I don't know what it would be. Like, is that fair? Or should they have to make a choice and be like, okay, you got this injury provision during the season when you could acquire these guys because you had injuries. But now when people get healthy, you have to choose. You can't have them all in the same lineup. Maybe you have to sit players. I mean, that's where I think players I don't know what the players are telling the PA. So, like, I don't want to go too far, but if you're Mark Stone, like, he's got a ruptured spleen. Like, that's not his fault. It's a terrible injury. He's now got to work himself back. But imagine he works himself back and, you know, maybe can't play every game because they did acquire other guys. And then there's this cap rule. Like, as a player, you might be like, what the hell? Like, all I did is get injured. Why should I be penalized and not able to play every playoff game once I'm healthy? Right. So that's the nuance, I think. I don't know where this is going to go. It's like, it almost melts my brain. Part of me wonders, I know there's a bit of time, but the next CBA is up in 2026, which really isn't that far off. You know, I would think 12 to 18 months from now, there'll at least be preliminary discussions happening between the NHL and the PA on that agreement. Maybe this just doesn't get resolved in any way, shape, or form until that 2026 CBA. It seems like there's a lot of moving parts, and I don't know how quickly business will get done to see anything shift in the very near future.
So what business did actually get done among the GMs this week at the meeting. There is one particular topic that did come out of it that I hope that you hold off for a second, because I know we're going to spend the most time on it. But what about some of the other rule tweaks and discussions that were taking place?
Yeah, there were 7 or 8 proposed rule tweaks, and some of them are very, what I would call, minor. I might tell you about one. You're like, I didn't even know that was the rule. Like, basically, if there's been an icing and you're about to do the face-off after an icing, the defensive player doesn't get a warning. He would just get kicked out of the dot if he had a face-off violation. Well, now they're adding a warning there. I'm just saying something like that is a proposed rule tweak. And so that really, unless you're very hardcore, really closely watching the games, won't affect much. I thought the most interesting proposed changes, and I just keep saying proposed because the competition committee and the NHL Board of Governors would have to both sign off on these for them to become new rules. But, you know, expanding the way coaches can challenge plays using video review. I think that is interesting. Basically, in this case, for a puck over the glass penalty, if this change goes through, a coach can challenge and say, hey, wait a minute, that deflected off something. That shouldn't be a penalty. That wasn't clearly shot out. For a high sticking penalty where maybe it was the puck that hit a player, or maybe his own stick hit a teammate, but it wasn't detected in real time and someone's getting a penalty, you know, there could be a coach's challenge there. And why those are interesting is twofold to me. How important, seriously, are video coaches becoming in the NHL? I mean, it's a video coach's job now. I mean, a lot of teams have two, but a video coach is responsible for initiating, you know, generally initiating challenges on offsides or a hand pass or goalie interference on a goal. And now you're maybe also going to be adding on to their plate the possibility that they have to, you know, initiate challenges on penalty calls. And the reason it's significant is, like, let's say you're the Flames, Julian, and you're playing Vegas, and, you know, Michael Backlund gets high-sticked. Actually, I'll do it the other way. Michael Backlund high-sticks Noah Hanifin.
I'm surprised you didn't use the example from the Capitals-Leafs game yesterday where Noah Gregor gets high-sticked by Tom Wilson. That looked really bad.
It did. The point is if you incorrectly challenge one of these penalty calls, you're down 5-on-3. Because you also get a penalty. It's the same way you get a penalty if you challenge for goaltender interference and the league says, no, that wasn't goaltender interference. Well, you get a penalty for that, for delay of game, essentially, for taking the time, for wasting everyone's time. So the point is you have to be really sure in these cases. And so that's a lot of responsibility, I'd argue, like on the video coaches. But at the same time, let's face it, where cameras are getting better, there's more of them in the arenas. Every sport is kind of wrestling to certain degrees with using video replay, whether it's, you know, umpires in baseball that could eventually just be robot umps. And the NFL's got a whole series of video review policies. Ironically, I don't think the NFL is being held up as a gold standard in that regard. I think there's a lot of confusion, frustration with the way they use video review. And, you know, I think the NHL is just tiptoeing a little bit more down using video review. And I don't blame them. I mean, if you have the ability to get the call right, you want to get it right. That being said, and I've said this 1,000 times, but I hate offside reviews.
Yeah, I hate them.
Because I just think there are certain offside plays that it's not even 2 GMs could watch it and not be 100% sure what the right call is. Like, even people whose whole life is about trying to help their teams win and knowing these rules and understanding the interpretation. Like, it's just a very gray area. But, you know, it sounds like we're going to have more video review, assuming that those rules go through. So those, you know, and I'll say this was actually kind of cool. They brought all the reporters into the meeting room where the GMs had met that day. And it's basically a giant square table with TVs in the middle that point in every direction, obviously. And, you know, they actually ran us through the clips. They explained the changes. They showed, like, it was pretty cool. That's happened a few times over the years, but it's pretty rare. And I think it was, you know, a real effort by the league to have some transparency, to have us as best we can understand why the changes might be being proposed and what sort of plays they're looking at when they're making those decisions. But that was actually one of the cool parts of the week.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes.
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Episode of the Chris Johnston Show is brought to you by Shady Rays. Get ready for the season ahead with quality shades built to last. Our friends at Shady Rays have you covered with premium polarized shades that won't break the bank. You have probably seen me with these bad boys. I love these. These are my favorite sunglasses. The look, the gold frame. Calgary is also a really sunny place. These help out so much, even when I'm driving to work. Love wearing these. They have hundreds of other options to choose from. Maybe you don't like that style. You will definitely find one that you will love. Plus, if they go missing or if they take an unexpected hit, they have the most insane protection in all of eyewear. Every pair is backed by a lost or broken replacement guarantee. It's awesome. Take advantage of that if you can. And if you don't like the pair that you have, you can exchange for a new pair or return worry-free within 30 days. There's no risk when you shop. Their team always has your back with personal and fast support. You can go to ShadyRays.com right now and take advantage of the deal they have. Use the code Johnston and you can get 50% off two or more pairs of polarized sunglasses.
Okay. What about the Alexander Ovechkin rule? Players are no longer allowed to sit on boards. Literally, I was watching the Capitals on Monday and I saw Alexander Ovechkin do this. And then days later, that's not allowed to do anymore. That's not allowed to happen anymore.
Well, you never were allowed. It was in the rule book. But I think it was a hard penalty for a referee to have to call. Like, are you really going to give Alexander Ovechkin a 2-minute penalty for that? But what the mandate is now is there's essentially you get one warning and then you're penalized. And so now, you know, and that's taking effect immediately.
Yes.
So, which is, you know, separate from the other things I was talking about where there's a process where they have to be confirmed as rules tweaks. So now the referees or linesmen have been given the ability to go over to someone like Ovechkin or Kirill Kaprizov or other players that are kind of known for doing this and say, that's a warning. Like, you can't do that. And the next time I'm giving you a penalty. And then, you know, which I think is kind of fair because then, you know, if someone ignores, you know, I don't have kids, but like in parenting, like you don't want to just come out and be like, okay, I'm throwing the book at you, right? You want to give them a chance to correct the behavior or maybe to not in the flow of the game. Maybe they don't realize you're doing something wrong. But so if you say, Alex, you can't do that next time I'm going to penalize you, then that's not a penalty coming out of nowhere. So this will be interesting. There's going to be a penalty for this, even still. Like, it's going to happen. And if it happens between now and the last game played this season, it could happen in a game with a lot of stakes because most of the games played for the next, you know, couple months matter. Because they're going to mostly be playoff games or even games down the stretch here that have playoff implications. So this is one of those ones that doesn't make for exciting copy if you're reading about it, but it could be pretty damn spicy when you see a penalty called in the third period of a game that team scores on that power play, or if it's against someone like Ovechkin, you know, one of the stars of the league. That's all I'm going to say about that. I just think it's going to be, basically, they made a rule to enforce the rule book on a certain play. And that's, I mean, it's been a rule. Nothing's changing. That's why they can say it's going to happen right away, because it's already in the rule book. They're, you know, one thing the hockey operations department spotlighted is like, look, this is happening a lot and it shouldn't be happening.
Alexander Ovechkin sitting on the boards, less than 50 goals away from passing Wayne Gretzky's record. Third period, an opportunity for him to add to whatever 2-goal lead he has in that game, and he gets called. I see it. It's going to happen. It's just, well, it's inevitable.
Forget goals, records, and stuff like that, which, I mean, I'm not saying they don't matter, but it could be the Capitals have climbed back in the playoff race. So
that's a really great story on its own.
It could be, it could be the last week of the season in a game they have to win in the third period in a tie game. And, you know, just imagine. I'm accustomed to just imagine what's the most chaotic way that something like this could unfold. And that is what will happen in the NHL. And for those old enough to remember the foot in the crease, Brett Hall goal, that's the ultimate example, because that had been a discussion point and all sorts of weird goals were getting called off for years. And people were like, why is this rule? even in the book. And then in game six, triple overtime of the Stanley Cup final on a goal that ultimately allowed the Dallas Stars to win the Stanley Cup. The rule was not correctly enforced, and it was immediately removed from the rule book after that. And so, like literally, you couldn't imagine in that moment a more chaotic way for something that had been debated for a long time to unfold. And so I'm not saying that there's been anywhere near the same focus on players sitting on the boards, but it's good. If this is going to now get called against Ovechkin with like two games left in the season and a game they have to win, and all hell breaks loose.
Craziness. Anyway, let's talk about the one big thing from this week that I really want to get into. And I know
the real
a lot of
news you're here for.
The real news. Amazon looks like they're going to be following a handful of NHL players for a series they're trying to develop. Who are the players? Who do you think the players should be? Let's talk about this, because I mean, we've brought up all these other cool shows on Netflix and that follow either quarterbacks. I believe there's going to be a wide receiver equivalent to that series. You're really into, I forget the name of the golf show, but Full Swing. Yes. Yeah. They're out there for all of these different sports. It's high time that the NHL gets into it. I would love to know your thoughts on this series developing and what it could actually look like. What insight could you give us?
Well, I don't have a full picture. I don't think Amazon appreciated the news getting out there before they announced it.
No, but, really.
But I will say the sequence of events is this meeting happens. The GMs get told about it. And then the GMs, you know, talk to people like me. And that's what happens. But I don't think so. I don't have the full exact how it's going to work nailed down, because, you know, I think that they'd prefer to have announced it all themselves. But that's a side note. This is how the sausage is made moment. But, you know, from what I could gather from what the GMs were told secondhand, they're going to follow a larger group of players than what actually really gets featured. And, you know, the best example, because I haven't watched all the shows that you referenced there, but I did watch Full Swing season two. I binged it, man. I thought it was great. But what they did in that show, like, for example, Wyndham Clark won the U.S. Open last year. And they had all this amazing behind the scenes stuff with Wyndham Clark from even in the lead up to that tournament. And I bring that only up because it would make no sense that they would have all that stuff, because very few people entered U.S. Open week saying Wyndham Clark is going to win the U.S. Open. But, and you know, he's got a very interesting personal story. He'd actually started working with a sports psychologist after being very resistant to that. But they had all this stuff from like the 6 weeks leading up to the U.S. Open with him and his sports psychologist, and like tremendous material that really punctuated where he obviously it punctuated his rise and how he got his game to the biggest moment of his career. And you're like, how? Like, I'm thinking there's 150 players entered that tournament. Like, how do they have all that stuff? But one of the way they do it, of course, is they shoot a mass amount and then they tell the best stories with what they got. And so my understanding is it's going to be like 10 to 12 players that ultimately probably get featured, we'd say, or get a lot of the airtime, but it'll be a larger group that are being followed, you know, basically starting now and into the playoffs here, because this series is due to come out in the fall, probably timed with the start of next season. Just as, you know, Full Swing just dropped now as we're getting into the meat of the golf season, same kind of idea. It sounds like there's some overlap in like producers and technical crew, like the same people that have done some of those other shows will be working on this one. And the early returns from what I can gather is they really love the intensity of the sport and think there's a lot of probability here. I'm left with one question, Julian. And I should mention too, because I know you're interested in the players. Like, sounds like it's like a Matthews, McDavid, you know, it's going to be, I think, largely the Stars. You would imagine, because, you know, in golf, Joel Damon, he was amazing. They did an episode on him in Full Swing one, Julian, just because I know you didn't see the show. And he had all, like, he was just such a real guy. Like, he's like, somebody has to be the 70th best golfer in the world, and that's me, and all this stuff. You know, like, he had no airs about the fact he's not going to ever go out there and challenge Rory McIlroy on a regular basis. And he became a star out of that show. Basically, he was what we would call a role player in hockey. And so I wonder if they sneak in the odd storyline like that, where it's someone maybe dripping with personality or is a little different from the mold that gets in. But I think predominantly it's going to be the Stars that drive the narrative of the show. The only question is, there have been behind the scenes shows before in the NHL. Yes,
there have.
not maybe fully to the quality of what we've seen in these other sports recently, but although I would argue the original Winter Classic, the Penguins Capitals one, I can't remember what that was called. Like that was, it was pretty spellbinding at the time. Like we'd never seen that before. You had Liv Schreiber narrating it. Like it was well done. And it didn't, there was a lot of moments, right? Like Bruce Boudreau, the coach of the Capitals at the time, like with ice cream on his shirt. And like, there was a lot of stuff, you know, a lot of swear words and, but it felt very real.
Love the swear words. Yes.
Yeah. I'm just saying like even the second one, which is when Tortorella, it actually opens with Tortorella just tearing into his team at an intermission. And like, immediately turn on, you're like, whoa, like that you could just feel the fire. Oh, Tortorella, it's a little foreshadowing for later in the pod.
I was about to say, we are going to bring him up at some point.
But they increasingly got watered down, and I won't say they all have stunk since, but you know, even you had the one, the All or Nothing series following the Leafs for a season, and like they all just felt like a little too vanilla-ish. There were moments, but they, you know, you got the feeling, and I guess look at the players, and there's a lot of people with a say in what ends up in the final product, right? And so it just felt like whether it's, you know, the NHLPA on behalf of specific players, or maybe the teams, you know, trying to protect team interests, or someone at the league, like it felt like, and probably a combination of all those types of people, you know, successfully made it about as boring as you can make it. And so my only hope here is that that isn't the case, that like, that we're allowed to have something that's like shows the real thing. And I don't know if we're going to get that. And we haven't got to a point. Cause as I say, like I got wind of this news, I shared it this week and I've dug into it as much as I can, but I don't have the full picture of exactly what's going to be in place. But I just hope that the NHL embraces the idea of conflict a little bit, like interpersonal conflict, embraces personality, because I think that can really help the sport. Like
you mean the exact opposite of what they normally do?
I mean, those are your words, but certainly they don't promote those things. Right. And, you know, especially if they're featuring games in the playoffs and things, I mean, that's a huge part of what makes the playoffs compelling is how much it matters, how hard it is to win. You know, even again, this is sort of glorifying it all, but like how much of a physical and emotional and mental battle it is to play a playoff series. And then at the end, you're shaking hands with someone that you just, you know, went at for 2 weeks back and forth. Like all of this stuff, I think can make for some great behind the scenes material. I just hope it's allowed to stay in. I'll give you an example. Justin Thomas in Full Swing season 2, he's at a champions dinner. He'd won the PGA championship the year before because a player named Mito Pereira basically incinerated himself in the final round. And he's like giving a toast with all like it's a very formal setting, you know, champions dinner, everything, fine china's out. And he's like, and lastly, I'd like to toast Mito Pereira because none of this would happen without him. And like, it's kind of a funny moment.
That's insane.
But it's also kind of a dick thing to say.
It is.
You know what I mean? Like, it's a year.
We love that shit.
It's a year later. Like, it's almost like, I don't know. It's not petty. It's not, but it's like, he definitely didn't need to say it. But but thankfully, I'll just say this. Thankfully, they left it in. It's, again, if you're a golf fan, it was like one of those moments you're like, whoa, he didn't, did he? Like, it's one of the things actually they tease a little bit before you actually see the official scene. Like it gets teased a bit. Yeah. Like they, you know, they spice it up. Rory gave a lot of very honest interviews. I just hope that we get that, but I'm excited about it. Like you have to go in assuming, like, I don't assume it's going to stink. I mean, it's the same quality of those productions. I just don't know if we're going to get the same, or maybe we're also too close to it. Right. Like, you and I live the hockey life, and so we see a lot of behind the scenes on our own already, whereas I don't, you know, the PGA Tour, for me, I'm just a fan. So maybe we're actually tainted a little bit because we actually see behind the scenes to a degree, and so we're just like, oh, we want to see even more. But maybe for the average casual fan, they already like what's out there. I actually don't have a perspective on that.
No, I think they want to see – I think they want to see stars, but I think they also want to see the personalities, especially in a sport where – we crave, and I mean we as in media people, fans, casual fans, we love the idea of seeing a personality emerge in a sport where that's just seems to go against the grain. So it's funny you were bringing up like who could potentially be in this series. I wouldn't be surprised if
a big section of fans who watch it end up latching to a personality more than a star because it's so against what we normally expect from the NHL. Or hey, maybe Matthew Tkachuk's in it and you get the best of both worlds. Remember how big he got last postseason, being the personality that he was, and also coming up.
He did an exclusive with People Magazine.
That was incredible.
I know, but I'm just saying, like, the fact that happened, like, you almost have to remind yourself, like, did I dream that? Or did that actually happen? No,
that was real. That was real. That was
he crossed over to a degree where, and it wasn't because of, like, you know, some torrid affair or something, like something that might land you in People Magazine. It was, like, literally just because he was a personality in a non sort of, you know, having success at a level and getting lots of attention. So,
do you remember during the NBA conference finals, the series in Miami, like, Matthew Tkachuk was on the inside on the NBA TNT panel with like Ernie Johnson and Charles Barkley and Shaq and all those guys. Like his star was rising, and that's a guy I would love to see in this series. I think he'd be great.
I should check if he's in it. I don't know if he's in it. I can neither confirm nor deny, but I was definitely told that it's going to be built around stars, and he's a star. He's a natural player to feature. Obviously the Panthers went to last year's cup final, and he was injured, you know, towards the end of that playoff run. Like, there's a great story to build around him leading into this year's playoffs. Can he repeat it? Can the Panthers have that kind of success again? You know, does he feel like he has something to avenge? You know, all the sort of, let's face it, these are all sort of traditional sports storylines told through new avenues and new people, new vehicles, but I think that they're compelling. And so I'm hopeful. I actually am hopeful, but I don't know. Like, I'm also thinking part of us will be doing our show next October. We've all just binge watched it and be like, yeah.
I can't wait to talk about that, because if it gets to that point, then I'll have a lot of thoughts for sure. But yeah, I hope it's not like the All or Nothing series, where at least at the beginning they brought in a lot of cool stories on the players, and then at the end, when you want to know more about how they're feeling, they just say, all right, we're packing up our ball and going home. Like, that was my biggest gripe with that series. At the very end, when we all know how it's going to end, that's where you want to see the raw emotion. That's where you want to see all the in-depth stuff. They just ended abruptly. That's my biggest gripe with that series.
I think part of it was, obviously, they were building that series up to be, this is like the season the Leafs get it right. Because they had like an outrageously successful regular season. They were up 3-1 against Montreal. Lost game 5 in overtime, lost game 6 in overtime, and lost game 7. So, like, it ended abruptly, partially because the season ended abruptly, I would think. But also, I can, without spilling too much tea, I know some of the people that worked on that show that were basically embedded with the team for, I don't know if it was the whole season, it was most of the season. I've heard secondhand of, like, a number of what they thought was the most interesting stuff that in my view, was fair to put out there. Like, it wasn't so crazy you had to, but, like, you know, again, built around, say, interpersonal conflict within the team or certain individuals in the team that all got ripped out. And I just think had it had a little bit more of that real spice of life, I think it would have made a bigger impact and been, you know, something we'd remember a little differently, but.
Oh, well.
It's anyway. A high, like, this is the truth. Even as a journalist, and, like, I recognize we are not that important in the overall scheme of things. No. It is a high stress environment working, covering, like, the playoffs, covering the cup final. Like, I've done it for a lot of years. Like, there is tension. Like, there's tense moments between whether it's maybe a PR person and a reporter. Sometimes it's an athlete and something, a storyline or a question, obviously on the ice itself. Like, it is intense is just the best word to describe what the playoffs are. And I just think that this, not that this is only just a playoff show. I mean, part of this is off ice and, you know, showing personality, you know, aspects of the players and their interests. But, you know, I think it's going to capture, you know, some of the story arc we built around a player that wins or a player that gets close to winning and loses. And I just hope they can capture that intensity and understand, like, put out there certain exchanges or certain things that are said and understand that that's just sort of the heat of what this is. I think, again, the reason we love the sport and why we love the playoffs is because of that fire. I hope that they capture some fire in the show. Cause I think that's how you sell hockey too, to someone maybe who hasn't really been exposed to the sport. If they watch something like that and be like, wow, this sport is like, because it is fire, man. Like, it's at its best, it's like a holy shit kind of sport, right?
So absolutely.
Passion.
I would love to know if this series ends up getting someone from the Philadelphia Flyers, and if they get anything with what's been going on these last few days when it comes to Sean Couturier and John Tortorella. I should mention for those still
speaking of fire,
we will have a Leafs corner. Just wait on it.
But
we need to get to Sean Couturier and John
Tortorella.
We're
running long here.
We are running long, but we'll get through it. John Tortorella, head coach of the Flyers, scratching his captain, Sean Couturier. We've heard from different viewpoints. Sean Couturier, obviously not happy about it. His agent pointing out that Couturier was confused about his ice time and wondering about the communication between both parties. Danny Briere has been on record saying that, hey, John Tortorella treats everyone the same. What are your thoughts on Sean Couturier getting scratched earlier this week? And what other insight can you tell us?
Well, look, this is what you expect of John Tortorella. Sean Couturier has got one goal in 27 games. His ice time had been trending in the wrong direction. And so this is the next logical step in the way that Tortorella does business. Part of his coaching style is to challenge individuals. Sometimes that's behind the scenes. Sometimes that's in public form a little bit or in the media. And sometimes that's by just outright taking away their ability to play a game. Like, I don't think anyone should be surprised by it. In this case, though, you're talking about someone who's named captain just over a month ago who missed basically two seasons of hockey. And so I think that there should be some sensitivity in a sense to what Couturier has fought through to get back and understanding why maybe he hasn't been totally at his best. Again, as long as he said himself, the work ethic's been there and he's been trying to do it. You know, I also did speak to Danny Briere during the GM's meeting a little bit, and, you know, he acknowledged that when he got back to Philly that he felt he was going to have to, or that he should have a sit down with Couturier and, you know, have an ability to talk about it. And so, you know, this is what you get with Tortorella is kind of my instinct to say, but also you can't say it's like a non-story. I mean, the GM saying he's going to have to go back and sit down with the player and meet with him and try to, you know, maybe clear the dust, focus the athlete, what have you. And it's just never boring with Torts is really all I'm going to say. Like, he scratched Kevin Hayes last year, one of their top paid players. He notably didn't play Roberto Luongo in an outdoor game in Vancouver years ago when he was Canucks coach. He can't help himself. Like, this is who he is. And you know, he keeps getting jobs. Like, it's hard to argue even the Flyers. Like, did anyone have them in a playoff spot right now?
Nope.
You know, this is, he likes to, if there isn't a problem, he likes to create one. Like, he likes a little bit of conflict behind the scenes. And so, you know, that's what this is. Like, and I don't blame Couturier. Like, I think good for him for saying he doesn't like how he's been treated. No problem with his agent expressing like some concerns. But if you're Couturier, what's the only option? Like, you just got to take care of your business, work your ass off. And when you next get to play well. You know, and that's what Torts would say. I mean, Morgan Frost sat like 10 of the first 12 games or something. And then he's had a great second half in Philly. I mean, he was all over the CJ's big board in the trade period in November, December, because it just looked like, you know, he wasn't going to ever work with Tortorella, but they found a way, or he's found a way to play at a certain level. And so I don't really doubt that Couturier will get there again, but I'm more interested in the next Flyers game than I would have been otherwise. I'll put it that way. Yeah. Just like how it goes, how that's all handled, who says what. I don't know if you noticed too, Torts in his post-game press conference swatted away another question from Anthony Sanfilippo,
I can't believe that guy's still in there and he's still trying to like ask. I'm obviously not gonna get,
well, he's an accredited member of the media. I respect that he's in there still trying to do his job. I just can't believe,
oh yeah, for sure,
I can't believe Tortorella's keeping to his beef.
Oh man, just
committing to the bit.
Anyway, I'll hold my fire on that. What did you think of Brandon Dubinsky's tweet? Former player of his, Torts, your tactics are getting old. Instead of scratching and embarrassing your captain and one of your best players, how about try and tell him I'm giving you 20 minutes tomorrow night, no matter what, with power play and penalty kill, and go play free, have fun, and effing get it done.
Well, you can give the stick, or you can, you know, give the, what's the other one? sweetener. Like, there's two ways to punish. You can, or to try to like get a reaction. You can criticize or hit someone with a stick is sort of the idea, or you can try to bring it out of them in a loving way. I mean, that's like, look at, I don't know if I'd be a good coach. So I don't, it's hard for me to say if that would be effective. I can get why as a player, you know, Brandon Dubinsky's thinking, I would like it if you treated me that way. You know, certainly we're seeing an evolution in the coach player relationship over time, but I don't know if scratching someone is, I mean, I guess it's embarrassing him. But players get scratched in every single game we cover. Like, you get the roster report, and it's like, here's the guys playing and here's the guys that aren't playing.
But who's the last captain who got scratched? That's not something that happens to a captain a lot.
That's fair, but like, there's no magic. Like, if Sean Couturier had scored more than one time in the last 27 games, this wouldn't have happened. Like,
I don't disagree with that either.
Tortorella makes the final decision, but the player put himself in a spot where Tortorella might make that decision. You know what I mean? So yeah. I'm not saying I don't have some sympathy for Couturier's point, but I'm also just like, it's a winning business. It's a performing business. It's punishing. It's a hard league. That's why it's the best of the best in the world. And so, you know, if he scratches him for 2 weeks or something, that's one thing. But I think one game, he sends his message. He spotlights, like, he's challenging the player, right? And Dubinsky's basically saying, you should challenge him by saying you're going to play him a ton no matter how you're playing and step up to it. Well, either way, either form, he's asking him to step up. And I got my popcorn ready. Let's see what happens.
Let's see what happens with that team. Never a dull moment when it comes to John Tortorella.
I love the Flyers. I got to say, like, the Flyers are embracing. I don't mean like I love them, like I'm cheering for them, but I just feel like it's an open door there, right? Like, it's just like they're comfortable. They're their own reality show. Like, they're comfortable with everybody just looking behind the scenes, speaking their minds, sharing. Like, I think it's great. When we're talking about selling the game, I think that sells the game, especially in their own market. They recognize that being boring and bland does not work for them, and they are anything but boring or bland.
I agree with that, and I hope they're in that Amazon series. Okay, let's get to Leafs Corner. Two very interesting interviews with one with a current general manager of the Toronto Maple Leafs and one who used to be. You had one of them with Brad Treliving, and Pierre LeBrun had one with Kyle Dubas, who now works with Pittsburgh. Where do you think we should start first? Do you want to go in on your interview with Brad, or do we want to start with Kyle?
Well, I think we'll just spotlight Dubas because I don't think there's a lot to chew on, but it's worth noting. Like, it's the first time that I've seen him in that article with Pierre LeBrun at The Athletic comment publicly on his exit from Toronto. And he naturally didn't say a whole lot, but Pierre had asked him, you know, when you were watching Brendan Shanahan go blow by blow, you know, on March 18th, we met and had this discussion on, you know, about like how things unraveled in terms of their contract negotiation and, you know, how have you not said anything? You know, I thought it was interesting that Dubas said, you know, in part he was just moved on and, you know, he got hired in Pittsburgh within days. And so he was just jumping into his new life, his new role. But also he had so many strong relations there that he was worried that if he, like, the interesting part is he kind of acknowledged, like, he's like, well, there was a lot he would want to say to sort of defend his side of that argument, that he was worried that it could have negative repercussions for people in the organization that he'd worked and grown to love over time. And so it just makes me think, like, there's going to be one day that he goes in on that. I don't know what the safe time period will be, but there will be one day. It'll be obviously probably after Shanahan's moved on. Like, it'll be when it doesn't affect anyone still really working with the Leafs directly. But Kyle Dubas is either going to give someone a hell of an interview on that exit one down the line, or maybe, I don't know, he chooses to share it himself. If he writes a book one day, like, who knows? I don't know how it'll come out, but it does sound like he, you know, I think it's also big of him to sort of basically choose to look out for his friends in a sense versus just like blast, you know, like try to defend his own turf. But it was like a little appetizer that left me thinking the real story there is good, is still to be told. And it's probably going to take some time. You know, as for my interview with Treliving, you know, I really appreciate it. It gave me a lot of time, more than I would have expected. Kind of took me through a lot. You know, which maybe I won't just spill it all out here, but it will help inform our discussions that we have in the Leafs as we get into the the final stretch of the season and the playoffs here. But, you know, like how last summer unfolded for him, you know, the Coles notes there, or Cliff notes if you're American, are that, you know, when he looked at the Leafs playoff loss last year, he determined it was a lack of scoring more than anything else that tripped them up. You know, it wasn't about not playing tough or something. You know, the element he felt they needed more of was scoring, and that informed, you know, some of the free agent decisions he made. I think, you know, he didn't use, he left me to fill in the blanks, but I think specifically Max Domi and Tyler Bertuzzi, you know, players that can score when it gets hard to score, kind of greasy goals, goals around the net, you know, having to fight to get there. I think it's been a nice part of the Leafs season. Frankly, those guys are each coming on, and they both had big nights in Washington on Wednesday, but they've played better of late, and they're really important pieces because, you know, can't always just be the top guys either. You do need some secondary wave when it really matters. And those players are there. You know, he also was pretty clear that I think he's high on his team, that he feels like they'll benefit in a strange way from the slow start they had, all the kind of issues from, you know, Samsonov being porous to, you know, it was a disjointed forward group. I think Bertuzzi and Domi didn't initially fit in well, and they kept moving the lines around and couldn't find combinations that worked. You know, the blue line had a lot of injuries and some struggles as a result of those things. But, you know, the Leafs have had a pretty good run now, 16-6-1 back to January. So they've won a lot. I think Treliving feels good about his team. And yeah, we don't have to go point by point, but you know, it was pretty clear that he thinks they'll benefit from having to bid in the fight longer this year in terms of playoff positioning and things like that, compared to the last couple seasons where, let's face it, the Leafs run cruise control the second half of the year. I think they're still sharpening their edges.
Looking forward to the next time you get to talk to Brad, and when Kyle eventually hits you up and says, "Hey, I'm ready to tell my story." I think you'll be the guy to get it.
I want to think that too, because I would just want to, I mean, why wouldn't it be? But also that's no foregone conclusion. So who knows? Even if it's in his own book, I think it'll be, there's an interesting other side to that story to be told. I would tell you, I don't know what all transpired there, but I look forward to when Kyle's willing to spill the tea. Remember, he used to have the Kermit emoji with the tea on his Twitter profile? Yeah. He used to have that.
It's a great meme. That was great.
That used to be his actual profile picture. So I think one day he'll embrace his inner Kermit, and we'll get that whole story. At least
would you write his book?
I mean, I'd write anyone's book. I mean, that's not up for offer. I don't even like, look at it. It would be hard to write his book now. I mean, it's been a great story. It's like kind of a crazy story. The guy was a stick boy in the OHL as a teenager and ran that team at 25, was a Leafs GM in his early 30s. He's now a president. He's not even 40 yet. Like, his story hasn't yet been told, but yeah, of course.
Okay. Duly noted.
It just takes a lot of time, bud.
It takes a lot of time.
I know you're looking at that too, but it's just, you know, I have got mad respect for all of our colleagues and even just other writers out there that are full-time writing books rather than, you know, 1,000-word articles.
Yeah, I don't know how people do it. Anyway, we are running long. Do you have a stick tap for this week?
I'm going to stick tap Rick Nash, nice. Who is named this week as Canada's GM at the World Hockey Championship. I will admit this is just a personal stick tap because I was, you know, this is where you do start to feel old, because one of my really cool experiences early in my career was at covering the 2007 World Hockey Championship in Moscow. Rick Nash was an absolute beast for Canada at that tournament. I think he won the MVP. I know he scored a goal at the end of the gold medal game with literally a player on his back.
Incredible goal.
Pretty cool moment. But I just thought, what synergy? That tournament, Julian, Steve Yzerman, fresh into retirement. That was the first time he was a GM of a Team Canada. Obviously, he went on to be the GM in the 2008 Worlds, 2010 Olympics, 2014 Olympics, some other events. But you know, that was the start of Steve Yzerman's sort of managerial career with the national team. And it's like full circle moment as Rick Nash gets that kind of tap for Canada leading into next, I guess, May's Worlds, not next month, but the 2025-24 Worlds, rather, for Team Canada. And so best wishes to Rick. And, man, I feel old because it wasn't so long ago I was covering him as a player. Now we're going to cover him as a GM of a national team.
Awesome. I'll give my sick tap to Henry Harrington, that kid who went viral in Calgary for doing the worm during a shootout competition in between periods during a Flames game this week. That was a really sick celebration. And he's probably the coolest kid in his school right now because of what he did. That was awesome.
That's a claim I could never have made at any point. I don't think I was ever... There was no moment, there was no week, month, day, hour that I was the coolest kid in any of my schools.
And look at you now.
Well, and I'm still not the coolest media member covering the NHL, so.
Oh, come on. Don't sell yourself short. Anyway, glad we were able
being
to get
cool is overrated.
It is. It really is.
Just be yourself. At least, like,
be yourself, right? If you're trying to be cool.
I was going to say, there's my little tidbit. Just be yourself. Don't worry about being cool.
Yeah, you end up being cool by being yourself. You right. don't end up being cool by trying to be cool. Anyway, you don't need us telling you, dear viewer, how to be cool. We'll be back on Monday with a brand new episode. Get your questions in now. Subscribe to the podcast however you listen to this podcast. And yeah, we'll talk to you guys again on Monday.
Chris Johnston Show. Inside the game, twice a week. Follow Chris on Twitter, @ReporterChris. And follow Julian McKenzie, @JK and McKenzie.